The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to this week's edition of Short Circuit. I'm your host, Rob Johnson, filling in this week for John Ross. This week we have New York's refusal to allow Choose Life license plates. We have a case about ostrich instructions from the Seventh Circuit. And we have a man sent back to prison because of a computer disk that the prison itself put in his possessions on the way out the door. So why don't we start first with a decision in Choose First v. Fiala from the Second Circuit. And this is a decision where New York refused to allow Choose Life license plates. These are the plates that you see with two children and a picture of the sun that's meant to express a particular view on the issue of abortion. The New York allows license plates for people who take a particular view on unions. They allow pro-union plates. They allow plates on other political issues, but they say on the issue of abortion, we're going to draw the line because this is something that is going to cause road rage and it's going to cause people to get into fights on the street.
Yeah, so in this case, the core question is whether a policy that allows the government essentially a blank check to approve or disapprove divisive political messages is compatible with the First Amendment. The majority reasons its way to the conclusion that it is because there's a policy and practice the government has of applying a standard based on whether a particular piece of speech will incite violence or, in the words of the statute, patently offend people.
This is a very bad decision. I mean, that's the bottom line. The reason it's such a bad decision is that it enables the government to pick and choose which messages it will allow to be expressed about divisive social issues and which messages it will not permit to be expressed, and to do so on the basis of no evidence whatsoever, just raw speculation and conjecture, frankly, probably insincere, about the likely harm, you know, in terms of the road rage and people reacting to these messages. This is a classic example of judicial abdication where the majority in a First Amendment case where there really should be standards and evidence simply says, well, you know, this message is patently offensive. Why? Because the commissioner of license plates feels that it is. End of story. That's a bad decision.
You know, I think that's an interesting, you know, point that something that doesn't even show up anywhere in this decision is the fact that many other states have these license plates. You know, driving around on the road on the way to work here in Virginia today, I saw one on the road this morning, and nobody was getting in an accident.
Yeah, so in this case, the commissioner has approved license plates that take politically divisive stands on issues. So they've approved a union yes label. They've approved a cop shot label with a bloody badge taking a pro-police stance. And the idea that a license plate with two smiling children and the sun is going to incite violence in the streets is ridiculous. There wasn't any evidence to support it. And yet the majority bends over backwards to defer to the government.
And then you have a very interesting dissent from Judge Livingston saying, you know, this is a case where, you know, the commissioner basically has unbridled discretion to say what does or doesn't cause people to have fights on the street.
Yeah, I mean, the dissent excoriated the majority for making the commissioner's policy look a lot more uniform and a lot more rule-bound than it actually was. The commissioner has applied its purported policy in a very inconsistent way. The standard is patently offensive, which is to say it's no standard at all. And the dissent takes a very engaged approach, focuses on the facts, and calls the government out.
So before we move on, just a quick word about the timing of this case. You have another case on essentially the same issue involving a Confederate license plate in Texas that's currently before the Supreme Court. And this Second Circuit decision was actually argued back in 2012. So
It's odd that they would decide to drop the opinion now, a couple of months before the Supreme Court's going to rule on this issue. It's some question, I suppose, whether this decision is going to be very long-lived. Probably not.
Yeah, so draw your own conclusions on that one.
Mm-hmm.
So next we have a case from the Seventh Circuit, United States versus Macias. And this is a case about a guy who was carrying money over the Mexican border. He thought he was carrying money for human smugglers, but it turns out he was carrying money for drug smugglers. And that difference matters because it's a difference of many, many years in prison. He was sentenced to 30 years because he was involved in drug smuggling. And the question was, could you be convicted based on for a crime that you didn't know you're committing because, like the proverbial ostrich, you were burying your head in the sand?
Yeah, so the government asked for this thing called an ostrich instruction, which is an awesome, I never heard of it before, which is a funny thing to begin with. But essentially what they want is an instruction to the jury that this guy can be convicted of being part of a conspiracy to move money for a drug cartel if he was basically deliberately indifferent to what was going on. Put aside the legal nuts and bolts, because those are interesting too, but one of the fun things about this case is we get some natural history about ostriches from Judge Posner. Turns out they do not actually bury their heads in the sand. There's a variety of theories about why that myth got started. Apparently they do lay their heads flat on the ground when they can't run away from a predator to try to minimize their profile. Another fun fact, ostriches have the largest eyes of any land animal. But that really doesn't figure into the court's reasoning. Back to Evan for the legal takeaway.
Yeah, so as Judge Posner points out, ostriches don't actually bury their heads in the sand. And in this case, there's no evidence that this guy buried his head in the sand. He didn't deliberately avoid knowledge, and the jury instruction misled, or may have misled, the jury into thinking that he had done so.
So bottom line, when there's no evidence to support a suggestive jury instruction like the one that was given here, it's improper to give that jury instruction, and this guy gets a new trial.
All right, so next we have a case called Childress versus Walker, which is also from the Seventh Circuit, and this one is a particularly outrageous set of facts. Here we have a guy, a condition of his parole is that he not be around computer equipment. And so on the way out the door from the prison actually puts in his possessions a computer disk that contains a copy of his resume and other materials to help him get a job. And then somebody searches his possessions. They find this computer disk still in a sealed envelope that was put there by the prison. And they say, you're going back to jail simply because you have this computer disk that's supposed to help you get a job.
So this is an incredible case. And to add one more thing, this guy does actually a remarkably credible job of trying to litigate a civil rights case by himself. He actually asks the court to appoint counsel, which there's a law that enables him to do that. The court completely ignores that request and dismisses his complaint on the basis that he hasn't alleged a violation of his civil rights because he hasn't shown that the people actually knew that if they put this computer disk in his, you know, his personal effects, that would result in his terms of release getting revoked and him going back to jail. And that's where we pick up the action.
Yeah, so as Rob has said, this case is absolutely outrageous. The warden actually admitted that this is not the first time that this has happened. Two other inmates have been sent back to prison as a consequence of computer disks being placed in their luggage and violating the supervised release conditions as a consequence of that. And yet the prison continued with this policy. It did not change it. And they're telling this guy he can't even get his foot in the courthouse door.
And just putting aside what the prison did, what happens next is even, in some ways, even more outrageous. This guy goes before the parole board, and the parole board says, you know, we don't care that the prison was the one who put this computer disk. We're going to revoke your parole. And then he goes to the district court, and he tries to challenge what's happened to him in the district court. And the district court kicks out his case under a law that's intended to stop prisoners from bringing suits, even though he's not even a prisoner anymore. Everybody is failing him every step along the way.
To me, this case raises two sort of big-ticket issues. One is we've created a system where government officials face essentially zero accountability for their misconduct. So, and by the way, there's no argument that they were actually trying to get this guy sent back to jail. They just have an idiotic policy that they haven't bothered to change after it has sent three people back to jail because they've put computer disks in their release papers, which they're not, some prisoners are not allowed to have computer-related items. So question one, are we well served by a system where government officials face no personal consequences whatsoever when they engage in this kind of stupid behavior over and over again, resulting in people losing their liberty and going back to jail? I think, of course, the answer is no, we're not well served by a system of zero accountability, but that's what we've created. And the second question is, why on earth do judges bend over backwards to help the government win rational basis cases, sometimes even inventing justifications that haven't occurred to the government, effectively serving as advocates for the government in rational basis cases? And then this poor guy, who's clearly been wronged by the government and is not represented by counsel, the district court won't even lift a finger to just do so much as apply the correct law in his case. So this is a glaring injustice that, it must be emphasized, was caught and corrected at the Court of Appeals level. It should never have had to get that far.
Yeah, so admittedly, there are a lot of frivolous prisoner claims, but that's no excuse for not giving serious consideration to someone who brings plausible claims of constitutional violations and has as much right to be heard in a court of law as anybody else.
And that's exactly what the Seventh Circuit did here. So all in all, we have a pretty good week for judicial engagement. We have two very engaged decisions from the Seventh Circuit, and we have one shining example of abdication from the Second Circuit, but it's one that's likely to have a short shelf life given the upcoming decision from the Supreme Court in Walker. So that wraps up this week's show. Join us next week for more cutting-edge constitutional commentary. I'm Rob Johnson, encouraging you to stay engaged.